Welcome to the Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays read by Leighton Pugh.
The 1860s. Norman Stone. Every now and again, Americans produce large, optimistic books. An early example was Hendrik van Loon's The Story of Mankind, 1921, which said that progress came about in rainy countries where people read the Bible in their own language. In the 1960s, we all read Walt Rostow's The Stages of Economic Growth, which made out that countries experienced industrial takeoff when they consistently invested 10% of their GDP. David Landis's The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, 1998, examined the cultural differences involved, and the book was impressive because it understood that not everyone finds McDonald's, feminism, and so on to their taste. But the best known remains Francis Fukuyama's The End of History, 1992, probably more famous for its title than its contents. It pointed out that democracy and free markets had taken over country after country, that there would be no more kings and battles history. Fukuyama's timing was unfortunate, very, given what was to happen in the world of Islam. It is really not a bad book, but its principal weakness was to look on history, as a character somewhere in Proust says, as a chicken looks at bits of eggshell after it has been hatched. For it had all happened before. You could, in fact, have written a variant of that book about the 1860s, a decade when readers of newspapers would have had one piece of good news after another and could believe in progress. The model was not the United States, so much as Britain. It wore top hats, not baseball caps. But it spoke of constitutions and free trade, recognisably the antecedents of Fukuyama's premise. The 1860s began with the formal founding of the British Liberal Party in 1859, but the most important event was the publication of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species in that same year. Has organized religion, based on biblical truth, ever really recovered? In 1861, Italy was united, a fatal blow to the Pope and the Austrian Emperor who had dominated it. Austria then abandoned the old ways and in the same year adopted the Schmerling Constitution, creating a parliament. Also that year, Alexander II emancipated the serfs. The American Civil War, emancipating slaves, began. New national states emerged in Romania, 1859, and Hungary, 1867. Then came Bismarck's wars of German unification, culminating in the proclamation of the Second Reich in the Palace of Versailles in 1871. There were parallel movements elsewhere, in Spain, for instance, where Queen Isabella was chased out by a constitution-minded general, Prim, and in Turkey, where there were extensive reforms generally known as the Second Tanzimat, also culminating in a constitution. It was a decade of great hope, and belief in progress was almost universal. The gold standard would guarantee sound money. Free trade would punish the lazy, forcing them to mend their ways. Schooling, in buildings that now look more substantial than many universities, would spread enlightenment. The Russians had a minister of national enlightenment, Narodnogo Prasveshchenia. A great deal of all this was based on an English model. An early Italian prime minister, Agostino de Pretis, even dyed his beard white to obtain the same authority as the chief exponent of it all, William Ewart Gladstone, the grand stalwart of what we now call classical liberalism. His charisma was such that in the evening after dinner, fathers of families would imitate his budget speeches for the edification of those present, including servants. Why Britain? It's a good question. It had not been a European leader. Its music, not on a German level. Its literature, not as sophisticated as that of France. The language, to purist ears, came across as cod German. Roger Bootle, in an excellent, non-alarmist account of the Brexit problem, the trouble with Europe, concedes all this and then remarks that where the British did come top was in political economy. They had created the first nation state in 1707 when Scotland joined England. Flag, anthem, national language. The great men of Edinburgh, David Hume in the lead, had a society for the abolition of Scotticisms, and in Gladstone's time, if a schoolboy spoke Welsh in the playground, he was beaten. The country somehow then produced the Industrial Revolution, and by 1850 accounted for half of the entire world's manufacturing exports. But all of this was done without an official enlightenment, let alone a revolution such as occurred on the continent. The German historian Otto Hintzer remarked that, from a continental perspective, many of the institutions and laws of England were living fossils. Freehold, for instance, translates as nue propriété and Freibrief, but these do not mean much, the state and the occupier having all the rights, whereas the landowner can be pushed aside. In England, not Scotland, a freeholder's leaseholder could, until quite recently, even prevent you from consulting the land registry. This sort of thing explains why Britain abolished serfdom only in 1925, when a labour rent called copyhold was scrapped. Serfdom had not been much of a reality since the Black Death. On a far more important level, the Mansfield judgment of 1771 ruled that it was not legal to have a slave in Britain. So this was a country that was very conservative as regards institutions, with a monarchy, an established church, a House of Lords, but also one that was rich, endlessly inventive and politically stable, or at least not given to violence. English freedom, based on law, was a model. Though when Margaret Thatcher pointed this out in an interview with Le Monde on the anniversary of 1789, she was punished by President Mitterrand, who decreed that in the official photograph, heads of government would be placed in alphabetical order. Royaume-Uni, therefore, followed Rwanda and preceded Senegal. She got her revenge, however. The party was taken to the Orsay Museum, where there was only one lavatory, down some steps. As a lady, she went first. She took her time and emerged to a row of African chieftains writhing in full tribal fig. Of course, it is impossible to adapt one country's formula into another's practice, as the UK discovered in the 1970s, when there was much talk of taking over German models for decentralisation and trade unions, or, for that matter, of Swedish models for anything and everything. The central paradox of English history is that feudalism survived without peasants. The rural population was 8% in 1900, in Ireland far more. Everywhere else in Europe, peasants formed a huge voting bloc, and they were generally not liberal. To protect butter makers in Germany, the Catholic Party voted to have margarine dyed to look like manure, whereas a British Conservative, Robert Peel, pushed free trade through Parliament in the 1840s, even though it would wreck the finances of many landowners. Cheap food made the British working classes about a third better off than the German, and caused a flight from the land to be even greater than before. A problem of adapting British agriculture and the common law to European rules has been chronic to this day. You can push history out of the door, but it comes back through the window. So it proved in the 1860s, as in the 1990s. The 1860s saw lawyers working out constitutions and laws to reform institutions, but this was prompted by finance. Money was being made on a huge scale in stock exchanges, many of them new. Fortunes could also be made out of railway promotion. The Hungarian aristocrats, by getting a railway station, became very rich because they could export grain and animals to the Austrian market. The middlemen involved were Jewish, who built houses on the Danube in an area close to today's parliament, so that they could arrange the onward transportation by barge. Budapest, or more precisely Pest, is the great monument to the era, stamped out of the ground in a generation, its canalisation arranged by a Mr. Bazalgette, sent by the London Board of Works. The Jews of Budapest had spoken German all along, but in 1860 they went over to Hungarian, and that shows up quite clearly in the countless Hungarian expressions that are mirror images of German. For instance, you do not call an election, you write it out. Ausschreiben equates to kiirni. The managers of Austria realized in 1860 that they had to change their ways because the treasury was empty and the Rothschilds wanted a constitution. A German liberal party arose and it dominated the new assembly in 1861. You had to pay a church tax and could not declare yourself an atheist. Jews did not want to pay for their own religion often enough, finding it absurd, and would not pay for the Catholic Church, finding it even more absurd. They converted in enormous numbers to Lutheranism. Money was at the centre of the 1860s, and two classic novels record this, Anthony Trollope's The Way We Live Now and Zola's L'Argent. Central figures are Jewish, and this was indeed a moment when they emerged in strength in money markets in Austria and Germany. It did not end well. In 1873, quite out of the blue, there was a stock exchange crash in Central Europe known as the Krach, and the company promoters went bankrupt. Many rentiers suffered as interest rates declined. In Britain, the era that followed is known as the Great Depression, not a reference to the 1930s, and the gentry everywhere declined in the face of agricultural competition. The classical liberals lost office over different issues. In Italy, railway nationalisation. In Germany, agricultural tariffs. In France, presidential rights. In Britain, drink. Liberals split in response. Right-wing ones in the German National Liberal Party, left-wing ones in what was eventually called the German Democratic Party. It ended up in 1933 with 5 seats, and when the members were invited to endorse Hitler's emergency bill, they divided, 2 for, 2 against, the 5th abstaining on the grounds that the others were dividing the party. That man, Theodor Heuss, became president of the Bundesrepublik. The British liberals went on in strength, but they were alone, and their strength owed much to the archaic electoral system. In the 1860s, very few educated people opposed the liberals. A famous case is Dostoevsky, whose Notes from the Underground shows the warping of consciousness that comes with liberalism and the neglect of religion. It is worth reading that book, together with the memoirs of John Stuart Mill, whom Dostoevsky denounces along with the celebrated French physiologist Claude Bernard, who showed what could be learned from vivisection. Here, in its way, is an admirable life, dedicated to public improvement and discussing what liberty means. He is interesting on all aspects, but remains, like most classical liberals, hostile to the survival of fossil languages such as Basque or Scottish Gaelic. But he ends the book saying that he just wished he had had some fun. He lost his virginity to a dragon when he was 42. The other great enemy was Pope Pius IX. On the very day the Turin Parliament passed a law making Vittorio Emanuele King of Italy, The Pope addressed the cardinals, denouncing not just the Italian state, but all of modern civilization. Mother and fecund propagator of infinite errors and interminable evils, which gives a free rein to unbelief, takes unbelievers into public office, and opens public schools to their sons. And, adds Indro Montanelli, more of the same nonsense. E via faticando. The famous Syllabus of Errors followed in 1864, a condemnation of 80 propositions associated with modernity, including feminism and positivism. And in 1871, the Pope's response to the unification of Germany and to his own confinement after the loss of Rome in the Vatican was to declare himself infallible. Heroism of a sort, but as Montanelli says, he spoke like a persecutor when he claimed he was being persecuted. The authority of the Bible had already been seriously challenged, and the Papal States had been a byword for hopeless administration. Pope Gregory XVI had even denounced railways. Chemin de fer, chemin d'enfer. And the last castrato survived long enough to be recorded for the first gramophone. The paradox is that Catholic political parties, sometimes with overtones of anti-Semitism and ultimately called Christian Democrat, then flourished far more than liberal ones. As Montanelli remarked, the liberals and socialists said different things in the same language, the Catholics and socialists the same thing in different ones. Pope Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum is a case in point, and a moment came when, in Milan in 1898, the army bombarded a monastery on the grounds that the monks were hiding anarchists, and the Swedish Lutheran Church was behind the contemporaneous strikes at Malmö. The Church spoke for the poor, and it also spoke for the national minorities whom the liberals derided, promoting Slovak or Flemish or Catalan and Irish. So the liberals comprehensively lost. Francis Fukuyama would have done well to consider this picture when he ended history. For it is Islam that then came roaring back to life, while the secular Democrats went down. As Benjamin Constant, Mill's equivalent, though he had more fun, wrote, "On change de situation, mais on transporte dans chacune le tourment dont on espérait se délivrer."
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolpe. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.